Hello, and welcome to Revolutionize Your Love Life. Do you want to know more about love relationships, what makes them work, how to create the one of your best dreams? Do you want to be in a really healthy, juicy love relationship? In these podcasts, we will give ideas and practical advice to light your way. Whether you're looking for a love partner, already in a relationship you wish could be better, or leaving one that has run its course, there will be something to inspire, empower, and support you. Revolutionize Your Love Life is a fortnightly podcast where you will access the knowledge and wisdom of love experts and relationship coaches from across the world to help you find true fulfillment in love. I am your host, Heather Garbutt. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning, Heather.
Hello, Helen. We're here today to talk about the myths and facts about power and control relationships. In our last podcast, we looked at what constitutes intimate partner violence. And today we're going to get to the bottom of the facts about power and control in intimate relationship. There is a lot to talk about there and it can get confusing. So let's try and clear up some understandings and maybe some misconceptions. I have Helen Eisenhower with me again today. She hails from Australia and is a qualified social worker, counsellor, and a trained mediator. She's worked with many groups of people, including adults with disabilities, children and young people in and out of home care, women and children experiencing domestic abuse, perpetrators of violence, and families experiencing separation. She currently works in mental health and has a passion for empowering people in their lives and relationships. So, Helen, can we pose you some questions and see if we can get some clarity together?
Absolutely, Heather.
Welcome. Now, when we speak about power and control in intimate relationships, otherwise known as intimate partner violence, are we really talking here mainly about physical abuse?
That's a really good question, Heather, and one that actually confuses a lot of people. Physical abuse is one form of domestic violence. However, it is only one of the forms. I spoke in the first podcast about the fact that there are at least 11 types of abuse, and only one of those is actual physical violence. So physical violence can often be used initially sometimes in a power and control relationship to establish dominance and control and also result in fear for the victim. And oftentimes it's never used again. However, in some relationships, physical violence is used consistently and or is mixed up with many other forms of violence. In fact, many victims that I've worked with actually would have preferred for there to be physical violence because it's obvious and people can see it sometimes. They can see the results of it rather than non-physical violence. But if you talk to the average person out there in the community, they often think that domestic violence equals physical violence only, but it actually doesn't.
Right. And that's really quite important, I think, to have clear, because it's often those subtle things that are less obvious that are really quite abusive, but that people don't necessarily identify them.
That's exactly right. We are conditioned to think that sort of dominance is established through physical means by, you know, fighting or those physical threats of abuse. And yet some of the most, while that is incredibly damaging to women and children, physical violence, and can result in horrific injuries, some of the more emotional forms of violence actually can really have a huge impact and long-lasting effect on people.
Yeah, and this leads me to think about anger, you know, because, again, you know, anger could be just construed as the abuser having a bad day and letting their anger get out of control. Maybe, you know, a little bit of anger management will sort it all out. I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit.
Definitely, Heather. I think that this is often, it's actually an excuse that is very often used by perpetrators, that they're just angry or they're letting off steam or they're having a bad day. Anger is actually, you know, all of us experience anger at times, and anger can be very functional in our lives. It can tell us when, you know, we've been trespassed against, or it can really inform us. It's a feeling that's very usual across the population. Anger, however, is not equivalent to abusive violence. People that are abusers aren't just displaying maybe anger-type behaviour, but what they're actually doing is their behaviour is systematic, it's patterned, and it is to establish dominance and control. So violence is a choice, and abuse is a choice. A lot of people that are abusers and or have an angry outburst as part of the abuse don't actually have that behaviour with anyone else. So they don't go to work and have those outbursts. They don't show that power and control behaviour with other friends. In fact, they're often charming in those other situations. So an angry outburst in and of itself does not constitute violence, but it can be very much part of the pattern of a perpetrator, where they have these emotional, angry, really huge outbursts of emotion, where they blame others and they're sort of just, the impact is huge. But it's not just anger, it's a choice and it's violence.
Right, I see very clearly. Thank you. And people talk about drugs and alcohol, you know, they'll say, my partner's okay, until they drink or they smoke some weed or take some other drugs. Is this really a problem that's underpinned just by substance abuse?
A good question, and it's a complex one, that one. Yeah, the short answer is no. You look around the world and people that abuse substances are not all perpetrators of violence. And the other thing for us to remember is that people who are perpetrators of domestic violence will abuse whether they're drunk or affected by substances or not. The thing here is that they do say that about 2/3 of domestic violence incidences do involve drugs and alcohol, where the perpetrator has used those substances. And those substances, as you probably know, they do loosen your inhibitions. They do, you're more likely to engage in risk-taking behaviour and lack judgment when you have been drinking or using drugs. However, these people will abuse whether they're in that state or not. So once again, it's that choice to perpetrate that type of behaviour to establish power and control, and it just so happens that some of the times perpetrators do that, they are affected by substances. But that fact is, it's an excuse. Their behaviour stands alone without that as an excuse behind it, because it's a choice.
Okay, that's very clear too. Thank you so much. So another question that's quite a big one for me, really, as a psychotherapist, you know, aren't the people who use power and control in relationships unwell, or have they had a tough childhood themselves?
Look, once again, a lot of the majority of people that perpetuate or perpetrate violence aren't unwell. They're actually quite well. And they actually make that decision, and they actually are very strategic in the way that they do that. They can make others think that they're unwell. However, the majority of people aren't unwell. And as you know, there's a lot of people out there that have mental health problems who are not abusers.
Absolutely.
The thing about childhood is that, yes, there are quite a lot of people that are in abusive relationships that are either the perpetrator and or the victim who may have had a very difficult childhood. However, once again, that is not an excuse to be violent against another person. Mm. It's about taking responsibility for your emotions, for your behaviour, and actually not perpetrating against other people. Mm. So once again, that is an excuse.
Okay, thank you. I think that's really important to clarify. And I think you said when we were chatting that there's research that supports your stance about this and your belief.
Absolutely. They've done quite a lot of research into violence, and they've also done quite a lot of research into the perpetrators of violence as well. And from the research that I've read, what it does indicate is that this is a choice, and it's, whether it's conscious or unconscious, it's a calculated act against the other person to maintain power and control over them.
Right. That's really good. Thank you. So I hear sometimes that people say the victims in these relationships, you know, actually bring it on themselves and almost purposely provoke the abuser, that they are to blame as well. I wonder what your view is on that. Is that true?
No, it's not true. No one deserves to be abused, and no one deserves to have every movement of theirs controlled and to have their lives dominated by another person. So no one actually deserves that, and there's no woman, for example, that I've ever worked with who has sought that out so that that will happen. What actually happens is that the perpetrator will blame the victim and often tell others. If that sort of relationship issue comes to light, they will tell others, and that becomes the common thread, that this person is crazy, that they have to, you know, they've had to do this, and they often present as the victim out there. So a lot of people will actually get on the bandwagon and start to blame the victim. And we do have a bit of that in our culture. You know, we have grown up in a culture where a woman, you know, got raped. It's her fault. She's worn short skirts. She's invited that. Somehow there's this theme where women invite this kind of behaviour. Mm. Well, women don't want that kind of behaviour, and they don't invite it, and they don't get into relationships so that it can happen. And I think, once again, it's just reiterating that the behaviour of the abuser is the abuser's responsibility. It's not the responsibility of the victim to change that behaviour, and it's certainly not their responsibility that this relationship has become violent.
Thank you very much. That's really clear too. This seems such a really important thing to distinguish, because I think so many people who are victims will think it's to do with them. And I love it that you're empowering those women. So, yeah. Do you want to say a little more?
I was just going to say that some of the research has indicated that the men that use abuse over, for example, women are very resistant to being influenced by women. They're very defiant and very defensive, and they will not take on their influence. So I think it's really important for women out there to know that not only is it not their responsibility to fix the abuser or to help the abuser, but the abuser is very, very unlikely to be influenced by their requests for change.
Wow, this is breathtakingly astringent, you know. Mm. It's making things very sharply focused and clear. Mm. I mean, I'm thinking about that other myth, you know, in the context of the woman is to blame or the victim is to blame. And part of that is the question, why can't they just stand up to the person who's abusing them? I wonder if you can talk a bit about that.
Often these women do stand up to these abusive men, and that is often why the abuse escalates, and that is often why there's additional tactics used to actually maintain or regain dominance over these women. Women learn that it's not safe to stand up. And one of the underpinnings in these relationships is fear, and often terror, to be honest. Women are too frightened to stand up to the abuser, and we actually tell them not to do that, because it's actually not safe to stand up to the abuser. Because just remember that the abuser must maintain power over the other person. So if the other person gets bigger, if you like, and becomes, you know, more aggressive or starts to stand up, the abuser will actually increase their abuse and their use of force in whatever way that is to maintain the power and control. So it's actually unsafe to do that.
Incredibly dangerous, I would have thought.
In some relationships, it can be deadly.
Right.
Mm. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So I think it's, in this context, it's really important that the abused person really understands the dynamics of it and can see that this is a wrong situation, so that they can then go and get support and understand that it's not their fault, develop a plan to leave the relationship that really prioritizes their safety.
Absolutely. That is the gold standard of how to manage once you realize that you may be living in an abusive relationship. That is definitely the best way, and that's the most evidence-based way to actually plan to remove yourself out of that relationship permanently.
Yeah. I want to revisit a bit about the notion that victims seek these types of relationships out. It does seem like particularly empathic people can be really easily abused in this way, because, you know, empathic people want to please, they're intuitive, they want to rescue, very often very loving. I wonder if you can speak around all of that area.
Absolutely. The short answer is women don't actually seek out abusive relationships, or they don't seek out a relationship in order to be abused. I do think that some of these perpetrators actually seek out a certain type of person, and they can be people who are maybe in a vulnerable situation where they might have just left another partner, or they might be in financial need, or have a circumstance in their life that's, you know, put them in that difficult situation. They also may be incredibly susceptible to the charms of someone, to the story of a victim story about this person needing help. And you're absolutely right. A lot of the women that end up in these relationships are so empathic, so caring, and they really believe that this person can change and can get better. And the issue here is that some men can change if they seek out long-term help and take responsibility for their behavior. But asking them to change, or, you know, debating with them about change is not actually going to create change. It'll perpetuate the situation and probably make it worse. There is some theories out there that women who have grown up in violence are quite desensitized to violence, and therefore might feel more comfortable in a violent situation because that's what the norm is for them. But I guess women do not seek out a relationship so that they can actually be controlled and abused.
Okay. And I'm aware that we're talking about violence here, but I want to reiterate that this is emotional violence, not just the physical violence. So I was thinking about, you're talking about desensitization to violence. So a victim may be brought up in a family where there's lots of emotional teasing. I think you said in our first podcast that it was about contempt. And I can see, you know, that the people that I've worked with, it's where there's competition, sibling rivalry can be quite powerful. It could be to do with bullying at school, where one person is continually put down, and that's what they get used to. So it's the water they swim in, really. They're not that's aware right. that there are healthy relationships out there, or what one even looks like.
That's exactly right. And one of the ways of, you know, the victim moving into recovery is to actually learn what a healthy relationship looks like, and to actually see that clearly for the first time, because they're often brainwashed into thinking that the relationship they're in is usual or normal, or they're lucky, they're not treated worse. That sort of becomes their story and their reality, and yet they often don't see what is a healthy relationship, and that's one of the signs of recovery, moving into that space where they can really take a hold of, number one, what a healthy relationship is, and number two, that they deserve one.
Yeah. Oh, I just want to pause a minute and just stand with all of the women that are at this threshold of leaving and changing, because I can really feel how powerful that is. Mm. If that's you, please know that we're thinking about you right now, this moment, and standing with you in support to find the support, practical support that you need to empower yourself to get out and to recover yourself and really fulfill yourself in your life.
Hear, hear.
And I'm also worried, you know, in this context about children, you know, in a way, if they see violence, they may well know that that's not okay. I don't know. Maybe they don't, because we've just been talking about that's a brainwashing from very early on. But what if they don't see the violence? Will they still be affected?
Definitely. Domestic violence and intimate partner violence with where there's children in the household very negatively affects the children. And I think it's a really important point you make. Often the parents of these children actually say, oh, well, Johnny was in bed, or, you know, Sally was at school, or, you know, they didn't really see it, or we talked out the backyard. But as you said, you know, they swim in the sea of this environment that is tense, that has fear, where their, for example, their mother may be being severely abused or belittled or humiliated, and where there is this power over dynamic. So for children to, you know, the concept of a child witnessing domestic violence, the word witness does not mean just see and just hear. It actually means they are in the air that's being breathed. They're in the air. It's in the environment. They are subject to this environment somehow at some time. And children can become incredibly unsafe themselves. The perpetrator may often abuse the children in the family directly, or threaten to abuse them. They often get in between the parents to try and protect, for example, the mother, and actually get physically injured. Mm. They're at a heightened risk of statistically of being physically and sexually abused in these households. So not only is there the emotional damage from living in this environment, but there is also a very real risk to the physical safety of these children. And children can also be used as a tool of manipulation. So often an abuser will use the children against the victim, and often the victim will talk to the children and invite them up into a role that is more of a kind of a colleague or a spouse, surrogate spouse, rather than children. So children are affected on so many levels in these types of, in these relationships.
Yes, I see that in the grown-up children of abusive relationships. In my work as a psychotherapist, I see that legacy, particularly when I'm doing the conscious uncoupling work as well.
Yes.
I've seen who the partners are that those children go on to choose.
Yes.
You know, that because of there been so many forms of abuse, which were considered the normal thing in their childhood, it becomes natural to them, and they don't notice then when their boundaries are crossed or they're disrespected or abused.
That's right.
And it just all goes around. Yeah. It goes around to the next generations. And I love it that the work that we're doing really breaks that mold.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Mm.
So we were thinking about myths, and just to go back to our guide list that we had, and I'm thinking about the abuser again. Can they change? You know, that sense that the victim just needs to help them and support them to change. We touched on this a little bit about empaths, but I wonder, maybe we need to just expand on this a little bit.
Sure. The short answer is that people can change, and abuse, and people that use abuse to maintain dominance can change. And I've actually worked with male perpetrators of violence who have changed, and they've taken responsibility for their behaviour. They've agreed to stop abuse immediately and make that choice to not create an unsafe situation. They've also then learned about how to have a healthy relationship, learned about their own triggers, learned how to manage their own emotions without blaming, and actually really getting the other person to take responsibility for their behaviour, their feelings, and carry them. And for me, the men that have really done well in that is when they move through that behaviour change program and actually say at the end of it, I can manage if you leave me, and I understand why. So almost that sense that they've come to realise that they need to totally let go and give the other, you know, let the other person have the freedom and their rights, even if that means divorcing them or leaving them. That is a sign of quite, of what would be considered change. The way these changes occur though, Heather, is really these men enter into these behaviour change programs, which are very intensive, highly accountable, and they actually do the work, and it takes quite a long time, and it, in what I've seen, it takes professional help.
Yeah, yeah. I completely agree with you that it takes professional help and a lot of support, because what strikes me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that these sorts of behaviours may have come about because of a belief on some level that they can't get what they want by being naturally given to. So they choose to dominate to get it. And so the beliefs that underpin that may be quite significant, that, you know, I don't matter. People won't give me what I want. I'm not important. I'm not good enough. And those are ones that obviously they won't want to be aware of. They may be unconscious beliefs, but maybe driving that behavior. So to undo that, you're letting go of a lot of protection. You know, the sort of outward aggression is a real protection from a deep vulnerability inside. And that cannot be worked through just with the kind, loving attention of a partner. It needs professional holding. And it also needs the will to do it. Because if you look at it on face value, why would you give up dominance and control when it works so well? You get what you want that way. And it's quick and it's immediate.
That's right. That's exactly right. And you also mentioned, Heather, that the women often in these relationships are, you know, incredibly loving and incredibly empathic. And I think that often the women have a taste, especially at the start of this relationship, but often at times in the relationship, a lot of these women genuinely love their partners, and they genuinely want a happy family and a happy home. And they genuinely have this dream that just somehow, if there's enough effort on their part and if enough love and enough forgiveness, that this will actually happen.
Mm.
And in a relationship where there is not domestic violence or power and abuse, they're right. That can happen. You know, you need to give each other understanding, and you know, and the relationship works through those sticky patches, and they get through with mutual understanding of empathy, working things through and problem solving. They are aspects of a healthy relationship, and they are actions that you do in a healthy relationship. They do not work in a intimate partner violence relationship and an unequal relationship. They actually don't work.
Right. Right. Absolutely. I think that's the key. It's the mutuality.
Yes.
Yeah. If there's not mutuality, it's not very likely that it's going to continue well.
I agree, and I think the confusing thing about domestic violence relationships, and I use the word, I shouldn't use the word relationship because it's not a relationship in a sense at all, but in domestic violence situations, the issue there that's very confusing is that there are times, and we'll talk about this in our next podcast, there are times in a cycle of how these relationships play out where the relationship does appear to be healthy.
Hmm.
It's not, it just appears to be. And this makes it really confusing for the victim.
Yeah, and everybody around them, I'm sure.
And everybody around them.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So once a victim really comes to realize they're in a power and control relationship, why don't they just leave?
A lot of people ask that question, and it's very complex. Why women don't leave. And it's usually the woman is too fearful to leave. Leaving is one of the most dangerous times in a violent relationship. Women are at most risk of danger and severe violence when they're leaving. So they can also have experienced threats. If you leave, I will hurt you, your family, the children. We have, you know, on the outside, we would have no idea on the threat that keeps them there. The other reason they often don't leave is because they feel so small, their sense of reality has gone. It's become the abuser's sense of reality, so they actually can't connect with what they need to do. They often feel their self-esteem is very low, and they've often lost or disconnected from their core self. So they often don't have a lot of agency to get in touch with inside them. That's all being dominated out of them, if you will.
Mm.
So, and they often are economically abused, so they often don't have the finances. They're probably socially isolated, so it's very likely that they have no friends left and they're isolated from their family. And all of those tactics are used to actually stop the woman leaving the perpetrator. That's one of their greatest fears, is to be left. So they create a situation where the person can't leave. So when we, you know, the average person, why doesn't she just walk out the door? That's ridiculous. It's her fault for staying and she must want it. They're totally not aware of the thorough complexity that underpins it.
Yeah. The intensity of the brainwashing and the undermining. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And we talked last time a little about the brain, about the brain fog that develops from that brainwashing.
Mm-hmm.
So the person, the woman victim perhaps, is really unable to think for herself and think clearly. And if she leaves, she may be sort of guilted into going back. I can't be without you. You know, those sorts of dynamics. Which
absolutely.
Yeah,
part of the cycle, which we'll talk about in our next podcast, Heather, is about how that pattern of behaviour plays out. And as part of that cycle, women often leave the relationship, but then the relationship cycle keeps going around into a much better part, and they often go back.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that in the past there's been research that it might take a woman, 10 to 20 times of leaving and returning before she finally leaves.
Mm-hmm.
So once again, those complexities come into play.
And even if she has then managed to keep any support amongst her friends, they've all got compassion fatigue.
Totally. Mm. Totally. Yeah. And after a while, they do blame the victim and go, well, I helped you last time, or I helped you the last 5 times and you've still gone back. I'm out.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Mm.
So what if they do actually gather some agency? What about taking legal action? Would that make it better, or do you think that would make things worse?
The victims are told and threatened a lot of the time not to take legal action, and they're often told that that'll be kind of the last straw, if you take legal action, because that is really outing the perpetrator. That is where this is no longer a secret. And they do talk about breaking the secrecy increases your safety. Domestic violence is a crime, and legal sanctions should be enforced. However, there are many, many dynamics around this. So the research does show that many, many women are safer if they actually can get some sort of apprehended violence order against the perpetrator, or actually let someone know in the courts and actually take some legal action to be safe. I know, however, that there are many victims out there who have taken legal action and they do have an apprehended violence order, and the perpetrator breaks that over and over. So I always used to encourage women that take out those violence orders, apprehended violence orders, to make sure they actually breach the perpetrator on them.
So actually tell them when they do it.
Yeah, so when it's breached, tell the police this is breached. Mm-hmm. So they've breached this now order, which becomes, I know in Australia, when you breach an apprehended violence order, that is a crime.
Right, excellent.
So,
go on.
Yeah.
A bit more?
No, you go.
I was reading something, and you never quite know what's true on the net, but I was reading something the other day that in America, under President Trump, the safeguards that include emotional violence, financial violence, abuses of a coercive nature that we're talking about have actually been decriminalized. They used to be considered part of it, but they're reducing it now. If I've understood it right, I'm reading the right side of the web, they're reducing it now down to physical violence. which I think is a massive step back for equality and for the quality of relationships between men and women, you know, forever. It just takes my breath away. If that is the case, I'm horrified.
I'm horrified.
Society, it's just awful.
If that is the case, that is horrifying. And for those women who live in abuse, they know that there are many types of abuse and they're incredibly damaging.
Yeah.
And to reduce it to physical violence, like you said, is just a massive backward step.
Yeah, yeah. And it leaves all of those women so much more exposed and vulnerable and abandoned, actually, by society.
It does, and it doesn't help in clearing up. These women are often in a fog, as you've mentioned, in that brainwashing, and it kind of almost plays into the brainwashing. Really, what you're experiencing isn't a crime and it's not abusive. It only is if you're being hit. So that is the exact opposite direction. We want to make it very clear that all forms of power and control that we've talked about, all forms of domineering, coercive violence, are a crime, and all of them are damaging to the victim, and all of them create an effect, and they're all not okay. No one deserves that, and you have the right to be safe.
So I think really we need to look again and reiterate this in each of our podcasts. If after people hear us speaking, they realize they're in one of these relationships, what can they do?
I think it's really important. A couple of things are very important. One is, if you are in immediate danger of your life, you need to call your emergency services and get emergency intervention. That's very important. However, another really important point is that once you start learning about the dynamics of domestic violence and you start to connect with them on a deep level and start to say, this could be me, it's really, really important to seek out specialised help from the domestic violence service. There's also websites, which we can talk about later, that you can go and check out whether this is a bit deeper, and you can do questionnaires, etc. So I think it's really important to actually go and seek help from a state, from people that understand domestic violence and understand the fact that knowing that you're in domestic violence and then planning to leave is a process. Unless you're in urgent danger of your life and you need to flee, that is different. But it is a process. And the other thing to remember is, you don't take your knowledge from the podcast today and you don't go home and stand up to the abuser, because that actually makes you more unsafe. And this process is about you learning the dynamics and the tactics that the abuser is using, so that you can actually out them yourself and go, this is actually happening. This is real. And this is not okay. And therefore, you're using that kind of sense of agency. You get in touch often with your anger and you go, I can't believe someone's treating me like this. I have the right to be safe. I have the right to my space and freedom and my own choices in life. And therefore, you start getting in touch a little bit with that anger and that righteous anger to actually seek specialized domestic violence help, do some safety planning, and actually make a decision on how you're going to leave, for example, this relationship.
That's brilliant. I was thinking about, as you were talking, the Center for Nonviolent Communication website, which gives lists very clearly of what is and isn't appropriate behavior and feelings and needs, which I just think is wonderful. I know we've got a wonderful YouTuber again. I think she's from Australia. Melanie Tonia Evans, and she has lots of stuff about how to leave. So that's something people can access quite quietly. They could just listen to that for themselves. Yeah. I think you said there were some websites, particularly in Australia, the White Ribbon.
Ribbon is an excellent website, and 1-800-RESPECT is an excellent website as well. Websites like that actually step you through what violence looks like, what is and isn't okay, exactly what you're saying, Heather. And they've also got lots of resources on there about how to get help and when to get help. So they are, in our world of communication today, if you can Google something and you're not going to be tracked, that's not going to be tracked and create more and more unsafe. You might want to do it at work.
Mm.
It's very important to start to create a knowledge bank for yourself about what these tactics are and get in touch with your own rights.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I think in the UK we have Women's Aid, yes, which also provides refuges. I actually do a contribution to them, that everybody that comes to me for conscious uncoupling, I make a partial contribution of my income to Women's Aid in the UK. But there must be equivalents in the US. I don't think we can sort of research and list everything. So please, everybody who's listening, use Mr. Google. Actually, should we call her Mrs. Google?
Mrs. Google. Miss Google. Ms. Google.
Yeah. Oh, dear. We can play with that. So anyway, Helen, thank you so much. You've been so informative and so clear. And my respect for your expertise is immense. Thank you. And lucky people who get to work with you.
Thank you, Heather. And thank you for your insistence in making these podcasts happen and your heart to empower people out there who are victims in this way and who aren't living in healthy relationships or even safe relationships. So thank you for giving this time and your expertise of bringing that to the table. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. So two more podcasts to come, and I think we're going to look at the cycle of abuse in the next one, aren't we? I think that's the next one in line. So look out for those and we'll keep you posted. And meanwhile, goodbye and keep safe. Bye-bye. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Revolutionize Your Love Life. I'd like to know what has been your biggest takeaway from this conversation. Do take a minute and share this with us and visit us on our Facebook page. You can connect with me personally on my email at heather@heathergarbutt.com. If you can think of someone who will benefit from listening to this podcast, please do share it with them. If you have any feedback on how I can improve it, please do reach out to me, as I'm always keen to learn more. Thank you so much again for listening, and we'll meet again on the next episode of Revolutionize Your Love Life.